This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For all of the energy that Americans purport to have, for all of our overachieving and super productivity, we are one sleepy country. Hordes of people are walking around sleep deprived. They try caffeinating themselves, but still doze off at work, in church, at the movies, watching television, in the barber chair on public transportation, sometimes behind the wheel at stoplights, or worse. Fully a third of Americans aren't getting the recommended 7-plus hours of sleep on a regular basis. Some are too busy, others have trouble falling asleep or getting the kind of deep sleep required to stay healthy. And all of this is costing us in terms of our personal health and relationships, and it's costing the country, too, about $35 billion a year in doctor's visits, medication, and lost productivity, and that might be a conservative number. Stay awake for the hour, and we'll gain a little insight into why sleep is so important. We'll investigate the pros and cons of sleep aids and get some tips for restful sleep. Dr. Nicole Mims is a sleep physician at Carolina's healthcare system. The mere existence of a sleep specialty in medicine should clue you in to how important this is. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And also with us is Dr. Kristen Daly, a clinical psychologist at Southeast Psych, working in behavioral sleep medicine. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And as we go through the program, you may have some questions of your own. You can do that at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. I think we've covered all the bases. Now, I said that a third of the population isn't getting the recommended 7-plus hours of sleep that some people out there, I guess doctors, recommend. How much sleep do we really need?
So it actually varies. So the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recently released a consensus statement on amount of sleep, and they recommended 7 to 8 hours.
That's for adults.
That is for adults. For children, they need a little bit more. In any case, it is recommended to get about 7 or 8 hours. The data shows that really less than 6 hours is the danger zone. So there was a study done back in 2002, 2007, that showed that if you got less than 6 hours of sleep, it actually increased all-cause mortality.
Mm. Why 7 or 8 hours? How did that figure? It's 7 to 8 hours, and school-aged children 9 to 11.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God! Yeah. Does any school-aged child get 9 to 11 hours of sleep? But who came up with those figures? How were they arrived at?
Well, there were a number of studies done that they looked at, and one of the most famous studies was probably the study done by Kripke. And anyways, it was it was done in actually 1.1 million cancer patients, and they did over an 8-year period. They collected surveys, and they found again that sleeps of less than 7 hours and above 9 hours, really, there was a slightly increasing mortality the further you got away from seven.
So it's based on analysis of the clinical data.
Mm-hmm.
If American adults aren't getting, if a third of American adults aren't getting their 7 to 8 hours of sleep, how many children are getting their 9 to 11 hours of sleep?
That's definitely a problem, and certainly there's been a big push lately to try to push starting times back, because a lot of these schools want to start at 7, 7:30, and that puts the children getting up to be at the bus stop around 6:30. And so a lot of times they're not getting to bed before 10.
And we've talked about this on this program before. We know that young people need more sleep than adults. We know that they don't function particularly well early in the morning, and yet we keep creeping the school day earlier and earlier and earlier. Why don't we just make it later and later and later?
I think that's the million-dollar question.
I mean, there's actually been, in Wisconsin, they delayed school start times for high schoolers and mm-hmm. found significant increases in test scores and overall GPA performance in school. I mean, the interesting thing is that as we go through adolescence, we experience what's called a delay in sleep phase. So there's a tendency to need to stay up later and then sleep later in the morning. Yet CMS schools start at 7:15. And, you know, pretty much about a year ago, they had a meeting to discuss, should we be considering delaying high school start times? And I've been in the Charlotte community for about 20 years, and I feel like it comes up every few years that we should be looking at a delay in high school start times, and it never happens.
Mm.
And it's difficult to understand because the teenagers need it.
Is it the school board, the teachers, the administration that doesn't really want it to creep later in the day, or is it parents who don't want it to creep later in the day?
I would say pretty much what we see is it's the school board, and it's more related to bus scheduling than anything else. And that's really frustrating because overwhelmingly the majority of parents want to see high schoolers starting later.
If you watch television, you can see all these commercials for sleep aids all the time on TV. And so it actually surprised me, given the number of commercials that I see, it surprised me that the number of people walking around sleep deprived is only 33%. I thought it would be much higher than that. But that amounts to between 50 and 70 million people in this country alone. Why is that third not getting enough sleep? What's the real cause of it?
So there's a number of different causes. Certainly insomnia is one of the causes. Sleep disorders in general certainly can affect people's sleep quality and their sleep quantity. And so it is important to screen for those as well. But yeah, certainly sleep restrictions. So some people who just don't have the time to sleep, obviously they're not sleeping as much as well.
Well, that was going to be my question. How much of it is that we're so busy, we're so concerned about making a living, we're working two jobs, three jobs in some cases. Some people are going to school while they're working at a full-time job. Is it that we don't have time to sleep? Is it that we're doing too much so we can't fall asleep? Is it that we think, like I do, sleep's a waste of time, and I can sleep later if you get my drift? Why is it?
I think it's really all of the above. You know, one of the things that has happened is we have 24-hour accessibility and 24-hour expectations. You know, so the idea is we see people working 24-hour shifts or a third shift in industries that never required it even 10, 15, 20 years ago. The other thing is that we have something that we can be doing to stimulate throughout the 24-hour clock cycle. So if you think about the idea of programming on TV that goes across the 24-hour spectrum, the accessibility of the internet, the entertainment of the internet. You know, a lot of cases I see in insomnia clinic, they're spending a lot of time online gaming, you know, in social media. And so their attention is sucked into this device that also then suppresses sleep because it's nice bright light exposure at their retinas and their brain's not getting the right signals.
So when my grandmother, and she used to do this, sat around the card table until bedtime playing canasta, or bridge or something like that, or sitting in the chair reading a book, laughing because the book was funny, that's different from reading on your Kindle? It's different from playing solitaire on your device?
Absolutely. So we have these receptors in our eyeballs that are called our retinal Zeitgebers, and that's literally German for time giver. And what they're doing is they are anticipating our circadian rhythm, and they're getting feedback from light exposure, telling the brain about the performance that's expected. And the challenge is that devices essentially are bright flashing light right at those retinal receptors. You know, so when I'm doing an assessment, it's really important for me to understand, are you reading from a book that's a paper book, or are you reading on a device? And the more often people read on devices, the more challenges we have.
So let's talk about some of the other disorders that impact sleep, not just being tied up in your device and all that blue light that comes and tells your brain it's morning.
Yes.
Don't sleep now, it's morning. There are things like sleep apnea and insomnia, but I've heard of those. But I've never heard of RLS or hypersomnia. So give us a brief definition of all four of those things. Sleep apnea, insomnia, RLS, and hypersomnia.
Okay, so sleep apnea essentially is a condition where the airway collapses and then we don't get oxygen to our organs, and that obviously puts a lot of stress on the organs and actually can cause insomnia.
Is snoring a part of that or a precursor to that?
Snoring is a part of that. About 75% of snorers have sleep apnea. So about one in four people who snore don't, but most people who snore do. And then to go to the insomnia question, so insomnia is a difficulty either falling asleep or staying asleep or both. And then restless legs is an interesting condition.
Oh, RLS is restless legs. Mm-hmm. Okay,
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
So RLS, which is restless leg syndrome, is a condition which it's really interesting where patients have an urge to move their legs at night. The interesting thing about restless legs, it actually tends to occur pretty consistently at a specific time frame, so between 8 and 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those patients actually end up working night jobs because they can't sleep at that time anyway. But it is a condition where they have trouble getting comfortable. They have to move their legs to get comfortable.
Hypersomnia?
So hypersomnia is a fancy medical term for being excessively sleepy. So those are the patients that we worry about falling asleep at the wheel and that kind of thing.
Is that because they don't sleep at night?
So hypersomnia in an adjective sense can be caused by not sleeping at night. But generally, when we think of hypersomnia disorders, what we think of is there's 5 or 6 different neurotransmitters in the brain that promote wakefulness. And in hypersomnia disorders, we think that people are missing 1 or 2 of those neurotransmitters.
When we come back, I want to talk about a little bit more about insomnia, exactly what that is and why some people have it and how it affects them and what we mean by there's length of sleep and there's quality of sleep. What we mean by quality of sleep, and then we'll talk about the drugs that people take for all this. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Try to stay awake. We're talking about sleep. Dr. Nicole Mims is a sleep physician with Carolina's Healthcare System. Dr. Kristen Daly is a clinical psychologist and in behavioral sleep medicine at Southeast Psych. I'm just curious about the title, behavioral sleep medicine. Do we behave in a strange way when we sleep?
it's funny. It's really a pretty structured licensure. But the idea is that a lot of sleep can be assisted by changing behaviors because behaviors influence the way our brain functions. You know, so
do we know why we need to sleep yet? Because I've read years ago that we're not clear on exactly why we need this sleep.
I will say that sleep is not fully understood yet, but certainly some of the things that we know about sleep is actually when we lay down memory. So sleep is very important for memory, very important for school-age children for that reason. It's very important for memory. It's very important for the brain to kind of refresh and kind of rest and that kind of thing.
Would it be safe to say or accurate to say that we sleep because all of the energy goes to our brain in those 8 hours so that it can process, it can defrag the hard drive, so to speak?
The funny thing is actually you see less metabolism in the brain during
really?
A lot of sleep. And that's because what's happening, you know, like we have this sleep stage called slow wave sleep, and it's a time of very little electrical activity in the brain. And we used to always think that slow wave sleep did not really have a major role in brain function. It seemed like it was a time where the brain was very, very inactive. And what we've actually learned in the last 5 to 10 years is that slow wave sleep is a key factor in the brain being able to clean itself. So it has a big influx of cerebrospinal fluid, and this is the opportunity for the brain to clear up extra neurotransmitter and synapses, cell production materials that might be left over, and this is key in protection against dementia. So it's actually really essential.
So we are defragging the hard drive.
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly what we're doing. Insomnia, is that a disorder by itself, or are there other factors at play that lead to what we call insomnia?
So insomnia can be by itself, or, you know, the way we view insomnia is it's a problem with sleep regulation. And it's often, we all have a predisposition to insomnia. So it's not uncommon for people
really?
To say, I come from a long line of poor sleepers. And so we have this predisposition, and then usually we have some kind of a precipitating event. So something happens, whether it's a stressor or a significant change in lifestyle that causes the brain to really struggle with sleep regulation. And then often we have what are called the perpetuating factors. So these are the things that make the insomnia persist. So let's say I struggled with sleep because I was stressed out about a test at school, and so I stayed up all night playing my video game instead, and now I am staying up all night playing my video games. And so what happens is often the ways that we cope with poor sleep continue the insomnia.
So we know that adults are supposed to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep, and young children, children through high school, actually are supposed to get 9 to 11 hours of sleep. Is it really the number of hours of sleep that we get that's important, or is it the so-called quality of sleep? And what do we mean by quality?
So quality is definitely important, and that's certainly where I see a large part of my patients. So a lot of patients who are getting 7 hours of sleep, if they're having broken sleep, so they're waking up a lot of time during that 7 hours, they're certainly not going to feel as refreshed as somebody who's able to sleep through the full 7 hours. And one of my jobs is to figure out what's causing those awakenings. I mean, certainly sometimes that can be just related to insomnia. They have trouble maintaining sleep. Sometimes it's related to sleep disorders like sleep apnea, restless legs. There are some interesting sleep disorders where people can kind of act out their dreams. That can certainly cause nighttime awakenings. And so it is important to screen for that. And if that one of those disorders is occurring, to get it treated to improve sleep quality, which thereby improves how people feel in the morning.
It's good to think about it as like we all have a metabolic drive for sleep, and we all have an amount of sleep that our body needs. And if we can get it in a continuous fashion, what happens is we're able to transition through the sleep stages. Our brain needs to function well, and we're able to have that metabolic drive met in a way that we feel refreshed. If it's broken up, we don't feel that
way.
But
we've all heard stories of these type A personalities, big executives, presidents of the United States. You could get along with 4 and 5 hours of sleep and these little 10-minute naps throughout the day, just little cat naps, and they're fine. And a lot of people do brag, I don't need a lot of sleep. They get 5 hours of sleep and they're fine. Are they fine, or are they just kidding themselves?
So my belief would be they're kidding themselves. I mean, certainly that a lot of people exist in a chronic state of sleep deprivation. And so they may not be falling asleep at the wheel, but they are not functioning at their optimal performance.
And what does that mean? How would you know if you're in chronic sleep deprivation? Could you diagnose it yourself? Are there things to look for in yourself?
That's a hard question to answer, honestly. I mean, what I would say is people who are in chronic sleep deprivation, that, you know, they think that they're functioning fine as long as they're not falling asleep. But, if you compare them statistically to somebody who's sleeping 7 hours, they consistently will score more poorly on vigilance testing and that kind of thing.
So if you're getting 5 hours of sleep or 6 hours of sleep, but every day at 2 o'clock, you take a 15-minute nap, or at 4 o'clock, you take a 15-minute nap. That's not making up for the difference? And you wake up from that nap. I could never do this, because I wake up from naps and I feel groggy for the next 8 hours. But some people that I know do it, and they come out of that nap and they are raring to go. Does that work?
If you take a 15-minute nap, I'm not going to argue with you. I don't have any problems with a 15-minute nap. Now, but if you are napping for an hour or 2 hours, the challenge is that what you're doing is you're drawing away from your drive for sleep for the upcoming night, and you're creating this consistent pattern of broken sleep. So what happens with a 15-minute nap is we just go into a brief bit of non-REM sleep. The brain might feel a little bit restored, but there's not this draw from the nighttime.
But if you have something that's preventing you from sleeping at night, and so you're tired in the daytime and you think, okay, I've got 30 minutes or I've got an hour, I'm going to take a nap. Aren't you wise to do that? Or are you wiser to slug through the fatigue because you might sleep better that night? Or what happens if you don't sleep better that night?
The challenge is, so what happens is that daytime napping becomes one of those perpetuating factors, right? So you take a nap during the day to compensate for poor sleep the night before. You've drawn away from your drive for sleep for the upcoming night, so you've just created a problem with sleeping that night.
Vicious.
And what happens is then you get to a place where you always need that nap and your sleep is dysregulated.
So if you're not getting enough sleep, aside from feeling drowsy and being a danger behind the wheel, etc., what are we doing to ourselves? What's happening to us? What can't we do that we think we can do and we could do if we got 8 hours of sleep?
Well, for one, metabolism is going to function a lot better. So what happens is when we're struggling with shortened sleep, but we also see our metabolic effects. So people gain weight, they have trouble losing weight, they have less physical activity, they have problems with attention and focus, problems with mood regulation, and then we even see effects on our immune system functioning. So they're much more likely to catch a cold and have more missed time from work due to physical illness.
So being habitually sleep deprived leads to obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, stroke, mental distress. What is the connection? What do we understand the connection between not sleeping and all those things? I can understand mental disorder because your brain is fried, but obesity, diabetes?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like they're all very complex relationships, but one of the things that happens is the neurotransmitters that are related to appetite are actually strongly affected by our sleep pattern. So what we see is when we have problems with sleep regulation, there's a big increase in ghrelin and neuropeptide Y, which are the neurotransmitters that tell us to eat. And we become less and less leptin sensitive, which means that when we eat food, our body's not as able to recognize that we ate. So basically the brain starts out wanting to stimulate with sugar, give me carbohydrates, keep food coming. And that continues this dysregulation.
So by not sleeping, we're making ourselves dumber.
Yes.
All right. In America, no matter what ails you, there's a pill for that. What are the more common sleep aids? I know the ones we see on television all the time. And under what circumstances are they normally prescribed?
So probably the most common sleep aid is Ambien. Zolpidem is the brand or the generic name of that. And it's prescribed for sleep. The best use of Ambien and other drugs like it, so Ambien is in the same family as drugs like Lunesta, Sonata, and the best indication for those drugs is for temporary development of an insomnia. As Kristen mentioned, losing a loved one or having some sort of stressor that's a temporary stressor.
But these things are being pushed like candy. I see Lunesta commercials all the time, and just the very name of Lunesta. Mm-hmm. It's a very comforting name, and they're telling us to ask our doctor to give us these pills, yes. And our doctors comply. What's up with that?
Well, so it's interesting. I was asked recently if
doctor.
I thought that's right. So I was asked recently if I thought that sleep aids were overprescribed, and I think the answer to that is in a way. I think that when patients initially start sleep aids, I think they probably need the sleep aid. So at that time, they are having difficulty falling asleep, and there is an acute stressor that their doctor is hoping to kind of get them through and giving them the sleep aid to help them with that. I think what happens is then nobody has the conversation with that patient to take them off of the sleep aid, so they end up taking the sleep aid for a prolonged period of time. And I think that's where we've gotten more, anyways, the American public has become more and more attuned to taking sleep aids because we start them and then we just never stop.
Yeah, the average sleep aid prescription is for 7 years. And the interesting thing is a lot of our long-term studies on these medications only ran for 6 months. So you think about, we have an exposure to a medication that goes well, 14 times what we anticipated would be the usage period.
There are, and I hope I say these names correctly, what are benzodiazepines and benzodiazepine receptor agonists? What are they?
So benzodiazepines include drugs like clonazepam or clonopin, Ativan or lorazepam. And those are the more traditional sleep aids. Those were the sleep aids that, 30, 40, 50 years ago, those were the sleep aids that we were using.
Why did we change?
And the reason we changed is because we found that there was a significant increase in falls associated with those medications. They were more likely to cause confusion. They could
very habit forming
tolerance. Patients often develop tolerance to them. And so then Ambien was kind of the Ambien and Lunesta and Sonata were kind of the second generation, and they are non-benzodiazepine receptor agonists. So what that means is that they stimulate the same receptors that the benzodiazepines stimulate, but because they're not actually benzodiazepines, the thought is that they're not as habit-forming and they aren't going to have some of these other side effects. What I will tell you is that we have discovered that that is not necessarily the case. Yeah.
NBC News reports that the use of Ambien and Restoril. What is Restoril?
So Restoril is temazepam, which is a benzodiazepine.
Okay. So the use of those two drugs may double someone's risk of a car crash, even after the side effects of those drugs have worn off, and they may raise your risk as having too much to drink. In other words, you get into the car in the morning after taking Ambien, and you're a drunk driver.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And again, it's related to the fact, so benzodiazepine receptors are actually very similar receptors to what alcohol hits. So to some degree, that's not that surprising of a side effect because, again, they're hitting the same receptors as alcohol's hitting and anyway.
Very sedating to the body. And the challenge is that when they're taking these medications, they're not actually creating the same sleep staging or the same effect of sleep that we would see when the brain's not when we're not using those medications. So the challenge is that although we have the sensation of sleep, I mean, think about it, how do we assess that we slept well? We remember nothing from the night, right? But one of the things that we know is that Ambien in particular is excellent about giving us amnesia. So we can feel like we slept well, but we also could have some pretty unusual behaviors that we don't remember.
Yes, these abnormal night behaviors. People get up and they walk outside the house. They get in the car and they drive and they're asleep.
Yeah, like 15 years ago, there was a arsonist in the Dilworth area that was taking Ambien.
Really? I didn't know.
That's a good excuse.
Yeah.
talk to me a minute about any sleep aid that you take on a regular basis. Are you really getting sleep, the kind of sleep that we're talking about that you need, or is it just knocking you out?
So to some, it depends on the sleep aid, but certainly in the benzodiazepine family, we do think it's more of a knockout kind of a sensation. So benzodiazepines actually they decrease REM sleep, which is an important sleep that we need to, function. The other concern about sleep aids is that sleep aids are very habituating. So taking a sleep aid in and of itself actually creates this phenomenon whereby you feel like you have to have a sleep aid to be able to sleep, which is one of the behaviors that we have to work to change.
Is it chemical in terms of being habit forming, or is it psychological? I've got to have this pill or I cannot sleep. I won't sleep tonight.
It's really both. I mean, the thing is that this medication gives you control over something you don't consciously control, right? One of the challenges we can have is that we can value sleep, we can think it's really important, we can want to get our sleep, and we can't force our brain to turn off.
Right.
And a lot of people who take these medications will say they can feel the sensation of the medication engaging.
I don't know about you, but I need a nap. And so we're going to have to take a little break here, and we'll come back and we'll talk more about these drugs and what they do and how we get off of them, since they are all habit-forming, evidently. And we'll talk some more about some of the alternatives to these sleep aids. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sleep, how to get a good night's sleep, the importance of a good night's sleep, the sleep aids that you take to get some sleep, but not a good night's sleep, and the alternatives to those drugs. Dr. Nicole Mims is with us, a sleep physician with the Carolinas Healthcare System, and Dr. Kristen Daly, clinical psychologist, behavioral sleep medicine at Southeast Psych. Let's go back to these drugs. For just a couple of seconds, Ambien and things like that. U.S. News reports that users of Ambien and Restoril have a nearly fivefold increase in the risk of early death. People who took fewer than two of those pills per month are three times more likely to die than non-users. Why?
It's a number of factors, but certainly one of the more recent studies actually indicated that patients taking those medications are more likely to suffer memory dysfunction and dementia. So that's one. They're more likely to suffer from falls. They're more likely to have confusional disorders. And
Ambien had the highest risk. If you take Ambien, you are at the highest risk of all of these things.
And that goes back to that amnesia factor. I mean, in the past year, there have been cases where people have gotten up during the night. They're not necessarily in cognitive control, and then they have behaviors that can result in big risk.
So are all of these sleep aids habit-forming? All of them?
They are all habituating. So, you know, there's definitely a distinction between physical addiction and mental addiction, and all of these sleep aids are definitely mentally addictive.
When you take a sleep aid, if you can't sleep, is taking a pill a good idea? Or should you just find other ways around it? Go run.
Running is good. Definitely, you know, again, I think sleep aids they're useful in certain settings. So I think that they're useful in patients who, for instance, have recently lost a loved one. But the important thing is to not take them all the time.
And the idea is really to view it as a temporary patch to like bridge that potential precipitating event and know that, I mean, ideally they would keep you on track so you don't develop those perpetuating behaviors. But the challenge is that there's not really any learning that occurs. So there's an understanding that the medicine helps create sleep, and that's about it.
Well, you don't get these drugs without a doctor's assistance. They have to write the prescription, and sleeping pills are among the most widely prescribed medications in the country. As many as 10% of adults take them at least occasionally, and some studies have linked these pills to cancer rates, higher cancer rates in the patients who take them. So are they overprescribed? Or if not, if some people really do genuinely need them for short periods of their lives, are doctors doing a bad job of saying, no, I'm not going to do that again. You need to get off this pill.
Well, I do think it's very important for prescribers to continue to have conversations with their patients who are taking these medications. So I definitely think that one of the conversations that doesn't happen with these medications is once the patients are on them, nobody has a discussion about whether to take them off. I mean, I've seen several patients who come in and say, you know, I ask them, why are you taking this pill? And they're like, well, my doctor prescribed it and he never told me not to take it anymore. And so I think that...
But the doctor has to rewrite the prescription every time you ask for it. So the doctor is aware that you're coming back feedback time and time and time again.
But what's happening, actually, a lot of times in these patients is they're just asking for a refill as they run out. It's not necessarily that they need that medication. They've never tried sleeping without it.
Oh, and I know. I understand that. But I'm saying that they have to go to the doctor and say, I need to have this refill, and the doctor writes the script. I mean, what's up with that? If the doctor knows that you really shouldn't be on these pills for 7 years, it's time to wean yourself. And yet it's just easy to write the prescription?
Well, I mean, I think a big part of it is doctors are really ill-equipped to necessarily help people get off of these meds. So often what happens, because it's a process. You know, a lot of times what will happen is a patient will be told, you need to stop taking this medicine. So they'll stop taking it, and then they'll lay awake for hours.
Right.
Because essentially the brain is looking for the support it's been getting from medication that's no longer there. And you can imagine after a day or two of that, that's very scary.
Well, can you de-escalate it? Can you get smaller and smaller doses?
Absolutely. And that's typically what I do, especially in Ambien. Ambien is very commonly associated with what we call rebound insomnia. So patients stop taking it and all of a sudden their insomnia comes back with a vengeance. And so especially in patients taking Ambien, I will wean them down, usually by 2.5 to 5 milligrams.
Yeah.
You do that yourself by cutting the pills in half?
You can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Here's some of the questions and comments that have been coming in while we've been talking. Chris emails, if we take a sleep aid, do we need more sleep? Or will 7 or 8 hours suffice to get the aid out of our system, the sleep aid out of our system? I'm often groggy when I take an over-the-counter sleep aid and get a full night's rest.
So it depends on the sleep aid. So certain sleep aids, so Ambien, for instance, has about a 4 to 6 hour half-life. So hypothetically, assuming you're a normal metabolizer, then getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep is going to get the Ambien out of your system. You know, different people metabolize differently. So some of those patients are going to have Ambien in their system even after they wake up.
Yeah, and the primary agent in the over-the-counter meds is something called diphenhydramine, which is essentially Benadryl. And that can actually be pretty sedating for some folks. So it's possible that because he's taking it over-the-counter, that's why it's creating more time.
Is that what's in NyQuil?
Mm-hmm.
Because I got to tell you,
yeah.
I've taken NyQuil. I can't wake up. It's
just,
whoa, baby.
Yeah. Mm.
All right. Anne emails, I have never had a sleep problem until menopause. Even when under high stress, I was able to take a break from the situation and sleep. Well, now, stress or no stress, I cannot get to sleep for a couple of hours, and I wake up after an hour or two and linger again before getting back to sleep. Any advice? Because I'm now taking Ambien.
So menopause is a very common precipitator of insomnia, unfortunately. I always tell my women, you know, menopause is great in some ways, but when it comes to sleep, menopause is really poor. It also increases incidence of other sleep disorders, actually.
I mean, often what we want to do is the biggest challenge with menopause is actually the hot flashes, because what the body expects is it's going to be cold at night. And so when we have this big increase in internal heat at night, that creates a massive amount of sleep disruption. So usually one of the ways that we want to cope is we want to try to make the sleep environment as cold as possible. With some of my patients with menopause, we'll use chilled pillows to help keep their head cold, because that's really what's pretty critical for sleeping well. And the idea is working to make sure you maintain a really healthy rhythm. You know, it is obviously it's one of those things that can be temporary. If you've been a good sleeper before menopause, it's not unusual to have insomnia be part of the process. But the idea is not letting your day get too far off track because of the sleep disruption at night.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, in terms of hot flashes, there actually is a medication, gabapentin, has actually been shown in small studies actually to reduce hot flashes. And it actually is a sedating medication, so it can help people sleep as
when
well.
When you talk about the keeping it as cold as possible, are you talking about the ambient temperature of the room?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, an easy way to think of, so the way that we sleep well is if we're working to get all our brain all of the right day and night cues, you know, so circadian rhythm, our brain's sense of time. And a shortcut to understanding circadian rhythm is to think about what life was like in caveman days, because our circadian system is really unchanged since we were cavemen. So we need lots of bright light during the day. We need absolute darkness at night. You know, our eyelids were not made to filter out light. So one of the challenges we can have is if we have ambient light in our sleep environment, that's going to stimulate the brain and inhibit sleep.
So make the room as dark as possible. Wear a mask if you need to.
Yes.
And keep the temperature at where?
65
degrees?
65 to 67 degrees. And we need to be warm and active during the day.
So if you keep the room temperature at 65, do you need to cover up?
Yes.
You,
Snug as a bug is great.
But breathe in cold air.
Yes. Well, it's really about the head being in a cold environment. So it's funny because we've even done studies. Can you sleep with hot feet? And you can, as long as your head is in the cold.
But you know, back in the old days, people used to wear nightcaps because they didn't, because all your heat escapes from your head. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Mrs. Claus.
Not a great sleep behavior.
Shouldn't do that. No. Shouldn't do that. Okay. Good sleep hygiene. What does that mean?
So, yeah, we in the sleep world, we kind of hate that sleep hygiene term. But the idea is that it's really about the behaviors that help promote sleep. And, you know, it's important to think about the idea that we have daytime behaviors that help us sleep just as much as nighttime behaviors do. So usually when we think about sleep hygiene, we think about, you know, eliminating electronics within about 2 hours of going to bed.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, 11 o'clock news?
Well, the funny thing
is
that TV is actually not nearly as bad as our devices are. You know, because our devices are so close to our eyeballs. So going back to that idea of these receptors in our retinas that are detecting light, the closer the device, the more intense the exposure.
And some of these devices you can program to change the color temperature of the device.
Yeah. So I've been in sleep medicine for about 20 years. And here's the thing. Every 5 years, it feels like we come out with a new wavelength of light that's okay for the eyeballs. I can't tell you how many patients come into my office who are wearing orange glasses because orange, you know, filters out the effect of light. Or I had one person who changed all the light bulbs in their house to orange light bulbs because that was going to help protect their sleep schedule. And the way I always like to conceptualize it is if you are struggling with insomnia, you need to think of yourself as one of those people who have super duper light sensitive eyeballs. So what that means is there's no safe wavelength of light. You need to be absolutely in the dark. You are that special case who's not going to do well with blue light or any other light exposure.
So dark, cold. If you go to bed at night and you find yourself tossing and turning, wide awake, and it's been 30 minutes, it's been an hour, it's been an hour and a half. Should you stay in bed? Should you get up and read, walk around, do chores? What should you do?
So the funny thing...
It could drive you mad.
Yes. Well, the funny thing is, so the recommendation always was if you've been awake for a while, get out. And that actually started in the late 60s by a sleep specialist named Peter Howery. And the funny thing about that recommendation is if you think about what it was like in the 60s, there was not a lot of activity you could do if you got out of bed, right? But the problem is that now we have a lot of things that we can be doing. We can be on the computer. I had one person who would bake cookies in the middle of the night and eat cookies in her kitchen. We have lots of light exposures. We have lots of different electronics we can engage with. So there's actually
wait, you just told me not to do that.
Exactly. So there's actually been a big movement to try to work away from that recommendation because there's so many circadian factors that can be engaged that it causes more of a problem.
Is part of the problem when you're tossing and turning and can't sleep the fact that you realize I need to sleep because I've got a big meeting tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. I've got to get some sleep. And the more you think about that, the less likely you are to fall asleep because you're stressing yourself out. Is that part of it?
Absolutely.
So that leads to Stephen's question. Meditation is sometimes touted as providing a rest state deeper than sleep. So how does meditation impact our sleep requirements? And if you can learn to meditate, could that help solve the problem of not being able to fall asleep?
So I often will have my clients do some meditation practice during the day because what we see is a meditation practice actually affects cortisol levels. And cortisol is our stress hormone, and it has catastrophic effects on our sleep at night. So I like for people to do meditation as an activity to help bring down cortisol. I don't love meditation as a replacement of sleep because it's not going to replace sleep. And I also don't necessarily love it as a way to fall asleep because what happens is we want to back away from anything that's associated with sleep effort. You know, anything I'm doing to try to force myself to fall asleep often creates more problems with sleep, not less. So, and especially guided meditation or listening to something specifically is going to cause problems.
I said in the very beginning that our sleep deficit costs this country $35 billion, the B, for $35 billion a year, but it could actually go as high as $90 to $100 billion a year. This is mostly in lost productivity, medical costs, maybe having traffic accidents because you're on a sleeping aid, mm-hmm. you have a car accident, whatever. Are these sleeping problems, for the most part, papered over by physicians? I only have 30 seconds left. In other words, do we just take a pill? Or do we get to the root cause of what the problem is?
Well, so I think the important thing there is, yes, we need to be getting to the root cause, but sometimes it is treated with a sleep pill. But definitely, I think the important thing is to, if you're having trouble sleeping, talk to your doctor about it. Getting a sleeping pill is not always the right answer, and sometimes you may need to come see a sleep physician or a sleep psychologist.
Dr. Nicole Mims gets the last word. She's a sleep physician, Carolina's healthcare system. Dr. Kristen Daly, also with us, clinical psychologist and behavioral sleep medicine at Southeast Psych. We've all earned a good night's sleep. Let's get one right now.